Blog Talk Radio.
And when I'm on the mic, there won't be no delaying. Bust a move, we shall
like a jam on the groove.
Welcome to another episode of Do Not Radio, the place where Knowledge is born. This is your host, Knowledge Born Alive. We are here on our illustrious Black Liberation Friday episode, and we are supreme honor and privilege to bring to this platform for the first time a woman of many firsts. I speak of none other than the dynamic mind of Queen Atlantis. Ty Browder is in the building. So the phone number to call in, family, 929-477-1755. Again, 929-477-1755. Press 1 with your question or your comments. It becomes my extreme honor and privilege at this time to introduce some presenters and others. Today's guest this afternoon here on Juvenile's Radio, Her Majesty is in the building. Queen Atlantis Browder is here.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me on your show. I'm pleased to be here.
Honored to have you here. Long time. I'm just thankful and honored to the Creator and our ancestors that our schedules were able to finally work, you know, to get you on the platform here today. So definitely a privilege and honor.
Right.
So we always
indeed, my pleasure.
We always begin with an introduction here, so you can take a little or as long as you'd like to introduce yourself, and we can go from there.
I'm sorry, say that one more time.
I said we always begin with an introduction here on Do The Knowledge Radio, so you can take a little or as long as you like to introduce yourself, and we can go from there, from maybe the three or four people in the universe that don't know who you are.
Okay, sure. Well, my name is Atlantis Browder. Many people are familiar with my father, Anthony Browder, who has written a number of books and taken study tours to Egypt for at least 3 decades now. But what I'm doing now is working to continue the living legacy of my father, as well as continue my own build my own legacy. Actually, when I was 7 years old, that journey began for me making my first trip to Africa at the age of 7 years old. And that trip in and of itself has impacted my life in so many different ways over the past 30 years. And actually, 30 years this year is when I made my first trip to Africa in 1989 at the age of 7. So that trip led to me writing my very first book at the age of 8. A good family friend of ours suggested the idea to write a book. And so, believe it or not, it only took us 30 days to write the book. Made the project like a homework assignment, extended homework assignment. So after I got home and would do my schoolwork, and I would jump on the computer and work with my dad to write that book. So we completed it. It was published in 1991, and since the age of 8, I've been traveling around the country, doing lectures and presentations at schools, churches, and with a number of different organizations. And so I did teach middle school and high school for about 10 years. So I have a strong passion for education, particularly working with young people to teach them about who they are, teach them the truth about African history, so that they can be inspired to want to do more, to be better, and to allow their ancestors to live and work through them. So that's a little bit of an introduction.
Definitely. A little something. And for anyone who has any semblance of consciousness, if they don't know who your father is, I think they are I think they done bumped their head somewhere, or they were born in the 2000s, you know. They were born in the 2000s, and yeah, they saw videos instead of read books.
I've recognized as I've gotten older, you know, we're definitely in the age of technology. And like you said, so many of our people are now turning to the internet, you know, Google, Wikipedia, and all of those sites to learn the information. Of course, in general, there's nothing wrong with that, but I think we do have to be mindful because there's a lot of misinformation on the internet. So
right.
I think it's important to find a balance, you know, and so while
right.
we're using the internet to do research and learn, it's also important that we read books. You know, we have to take it back because it's my understanding that, and I'm sure you probably know this as well, but not only is reading fundamental, but it actually builds muscles in the brain. Just like you go to a gym and work out your arms, your legs, your abs, reading helps to build the muscles of the mind. And, you know, that's a whole other topic, but yeah, we definitely have to get our people back to this reading book, you know?
Right. I found books and books found me. You know, my behavior warranted me a lot of punishment when I was young. So I spent a lot of time reading, and reading was never a chore or a punishment. Reading was an escape in the doorway into a whole nother world that existed outside of the four walls of North New Jersey. So reading took me places that I would eventually go to many of these places, you know, and you know, it was that early on spark from my mother and my family in regards to, you know, reading and the importance of education, you know, that propelled me on the journey, you know, by hook or crook in a certain direction. And, you know, one of the brothers that was near and dear to me as an elder gave me the Browder Files, you know, as a teenager, you know, me and a couple other brothers. And it was on from then in regards to, you know, our minds being challenged and us having to do deep research and study and things like that. You know, we already did that for academia, but as far as, you know, ourselves, and then we would find that there were not a lot of places that were tailored towards the development of the young African mind. In existence in regards to bookstores and things like that. Many of those things came later, and they didn't last long through the 80s and the early 90s. You know, a lot of those stores were burnt to the ground, things like that. So we had to find it where we could get it. And, you know, whether that was microfiche or, you know, somebody's basement, whatever the case may be, we're peering through and showing our fidelity and zeal to learn and to, you know, begin that process of re-Africanizing ourselves through that process. So definitely very critical, your father's work in our development along the way.
Well, you know, something that you said that I think is really important is your reference to your parents and then bringing you up in an environment where reading is important. You know, they value reading and therefore encourage you to do the same. And so my experience was definitely very similar to that with regards to being raised by my father, who's a single parent. But one of the things that I always admired about my father, not just because he, you know, was heavy on education, heavy on reading, but he modeled it. You know, as a father, he modeled everything that he expected of me. And reading was one of those things that he modeled. So I can recall almost every day, you know, coming home from school and throughout the evening, seeing my father read, whether it was books, magazines, newspaper articles, he was always reading. And I very rarely saw him watch TV. If he did, it might have been his favorite show was Star Trek, and every once in a while he might watch Cheers, but I rarely saw him watching TV, you know? So the fact that he I'm not sure if he consciously modeled that, but I know that he was, you know, big on reading, loved to learn, loved to read. And so as I got older and reflecting on, you know, different things that my father did to influence me, that was the primary thing that really stood out, him modeling for me. You know, there is a tendency for some of our people, particularly in the older generation, they always tell young people to, you know, follow as they, you know, do what they say, not as they do. And, you know, that phrase always baffled me. You know, I can never understand how an adult would tell a child to, you know, don't do as I do. Don't worry about what I'm doing. Don't imitate that. You just listen to what I'm saying. And so it's so important for adults to understand that children are like sponges. They're watching everything. And on a subconscious level, they're picking all of that. All of those experiences are being encoded in their DNA. And so essentially parents, you know, adults in general, I think we have to step up and do more to model what we expect for young people, because it's almost a slap in the face to tell them, you know, don't imitate me, but just listen to what I'm saying and do what I say, you know. So that's at least one thing in particular that I think we as adults can begin to do for young people. So whether it includes cursing, I never heard my father say a curse word until I was like over 18 or 21, you know. So there's a lot of little things that I can look back and really appreciate, you know, in terms of what my father did. And that really helped me and inspired me to want to model that same behavior for the young people that I taught, as well as that I've worked with in other areas.
Right. Wow. Wow. So much was just said, you know, just now. You know, things, you know, we didn't know. So I think that was a beautiful way for my next question. You know, everybody's read the autobiography of Malcolm X, but not many people commonly have read Growing Up X, you know, by one of Malcolm's daughters. You know, what was it like for you growing up, Browder, you know, in this particular time? You just touched on some examples, so I want to stay there. What was that like for you?
I'm sorry. What you said, what was it like growing up with what?
For you growing up, Browder, you know, we read the Browder Files, you know what I'm saying? So I wanted to go into the Browder Files that we could hear from you, you know. What was it like growing up, Browder?
Well, to be honest with you, I really didn't. Well, let's put it like this. As a child, you know, well, of course, while I had friends in the neighborhood and in other areas, for a short period of time, you know, I actually thought that most children had the same experience as me. You know, they had a father who you know, talk to them about African history and culture. You know, they had a father who traveled, and it, you know, didn't take too long before I realized that my experience was extremely different from many of my peers, most who, if they did not have both parents in the household, they were, you know, raised by a raised by their mothers. And so I, you know, just to give you an example, I can recall on some instances my friends talking about, you know, their deadbeat dads and, you know, just had nothing to say about their father. But that wasn't my experience. My father played a very important role in my life. And so it really wasn't until I went away to college. My first 3 years, I attended Hampton University. And so that was my first time being away from home for an extended period of time. And I can recall, you know, different places, either on campus or off campus, I would meet people. And they would say, you know, either I would, you know, maybe say my name or, you know, somehow the conversation would come up. But ultimately, they would learn who my father was. Oh, Mr. Browder, that's your father? Oh, you know, I read his book for the Browderfile in Nile Valley, and it changed my life. And, you know, they were just so excited. And to be honest with you, at that age, so we're talking about, what, 17, 18, you know, I'm like, okay, you're getting a little excited there. I could not understand why these people were so excited. They had never met my dad before, but they were familiar with his work and how, and you know, it had such a great impact. And it was at that time that, you know, I've always loved and appreciated my father, but at that point in time, I was able to gain a little bit more appreciation for his work and the impact that it had on people. And so, you know, around that time is when I decided that, you know, I want to have that same impact, not for, you know, the fame, not to receive any recognition or anything like that, but I want to be able to produce material that impacts people like that. And so, as I've gotten older and, you know, had more experience, I've traveled more, I have accepted that part of my reason for coming here to this physical plane is to do specific work. And I do believe that my father laid the foundation for that work, for the work that I was going to be doing in this lifetime. To a large extent, I even believe that, you know, on a spiritual plane, before we come to this earth, we actually choose our parents. Everybody in our life, whether it's friends or, you know, other family members, we all have some type of karmic connection. And so once I began to realize that, I was more open to embracing the idea of this work that was ahead of me. So, you know, growing up with my father was fun. A lot of people, you know, they'll see him and, oh, he looks strict. Oh, he looks mean. And I said, oh, if only you knew. My father's very humorous. He likes to have fun. But at the same time, he knows when to be serious, you know. So he always provided that balance of, you know, being serious, getting work done, but also relaxing, having fun, and really enjoying and appreciating life. So I'm at a point now where I appreciate my father, everything he's done for me and the work that he's done. I appreciate it so much more now that I'm older. And I can look back now in my college days and understand why people got so excited about this work and, to a large extent, why it impacted them. And so that's the role that I'm following now to, you know, continue writing books to educate our people, but particularly young people. I mentioned that this, well, actually, I don't know if I mentioned it, but this year is actually the 30th anniversary of the publication of From the Browderfile. So 1989 is when he wrote that book, and what shocked me to this day is that 30 years after that book was published, my father still receives dozens and dozens of letters from inmates, particularly males, who are, you know, maybe writing for one or two reasons. Either they, you know, they're informing us that they just came across From the Browderfile and it's changed their lives, and they wish that they had read that book before they got locked up, because maybe they would not have gone down the path that they're on. And so what many of them want to do is now get copies of that book from the Browder file for their relatives, for their children, copies of my first book, My First Trip to Africa, get that for their children so that they can introduce them to this information so that they can be more informed about African history and culture and begin the process of understanding who they are, what they were born here for, and knowing that they do have a purpose. Every single human being on this planet was born for a reason, and there's so many different paths that we could take in general, but it's important that we teach young people early on to start reflecting on who they are, thinking about what their passions are, what their desires are, but most importantly, you know, we don't want to just do something that makes us happy, but also believe it's important for us to give back and help others. And so I've seen that, you know, with my dad over the years, helping other people, teaching other people, but then also knowing when not to help people, because some people aren't ready. Some people don't value, you know, some of the information that we're trying to share. So it's about meeting people where they are. And you just kind of, you don't overwhelm folks with information, but you kind of spoon feed them, just give them a little bit at a time. And when they're ready, they'll come back and start asking questions or ask what they can do to, you know, follow similar footsteps. You know? So to answer your question, it was great. I really loved growing up with my father, and I wouldn't trade it for the world. I wouldn't trade it for the world.
I agree wholeheartedly with you. That is something that I shared with my mother and saying, and it really just brought me to her when you were speaking, you know, consciously on some level. I believe we choose our parents. Like, we have this contractual agreement via spirit before animating into the physical realm, you know. I just found it so profound. So shout out to my mother, you know, for letting me know that she's listening somewhere. You understand what I'm saying? To have you, you know, say that in the way that you said it. I just thought it was something that we shared like it was a family secret. You know, it's nice to know that these things are still going on in African families where we have an understanding of a relationship before a time that transcends the physical realm. You know, I just think that was very, very remarkable. So,
okay. Can
I ask about your spiritual journey?
So, my spiritual journey, I would say I consciously recognized that path when I was about 17 or 18. My grandmother, who helped my father raise me, she was, I won't say that she was a religious woman. You know, she didn't necessarily beat me over the head with the Bible, but she did go to church. And so my early years, I would say from what, maybe 4 or 5 up until maybe 12, you know, around that time, I was in the church. You know, I went to church with my grandmother every Sunday. And it got to a point during my preteen years where I didn't want to go to church anymore. I didn't want to go to church for a variety of reasons. But once I made that decision within myself, you know, I expressed that to her. She wasn't trying to hear it. You know, I would, on those Sundays, she would come in, wake me up, and I would, you know, take very long to get up, you know, try to prolong the process. But I still ended up going. And so I, you know, had a conversation with my father, and I told him that, you know, I didn't want to go to church anymore, and do I have to go? And so he was able to step in and support me with that very important decision. And so around 12 or 13, that's when I actually stopped going to church. The interesting thing, though, is that I've been in private schools from sixth through 12th grade. I've attended Catholic schools and Seventh-day Adventist schools, so I've always been surrounded by religion, at least as it relates to education in my early years. And so if you can imagine, in one ear, you know, I have my grandmother and, you know, other religious people who are, you know, speaking the Bible and talking about Christianity. But then on the other end, I have my father, who is teaching me about African history and culture, which I didn't learn in the church. I have my father who's teaching me about spirituality, which is not the same as religion. I have my father who's teaching me more specifically about African spirituality, about the origins of Christianity. So at a very young age, I'm being exposed to all this information. And, you know, in the church, you can't necessarily ask questions, or if you do, they won't get answered. And so it just got to a point where I didn't feel comfortable. It wasn't, I didn't enjoy going to church, not because of the people. The people were amazing, very friendly, and, you know, played different roles in my life growing up. But just the message, it didn't resonate with me. And so I think it was during my freshman year, my father bought me a copy of a book written by Joseph Murphy, and it's called The Power of Your Subconscious Mind. And it might have been right before or just after, but he gave me another book called As a Man Thinketh. Now they have another version for women, As a Woman Thinketh, by James Allen. And so my father, you know, during those 10 years, he was introducing me to universal concepts, you know, different aspects of spirituality. And so as my knowledge was growing, it made me move away from the church even further. And so there was, or there is, a woman by the name of Marion Davis, who lives in South Carolina, and I often like to refer to her as my spiritual counselor, or my angel in the physical form, because while I had my father on one end as a male introducing me to this information, Marion was the female who provided that balance. I really didn't have very many females in my life who I could really talk to on a personal level about spirituality and my personal growth. So between she and my father, they both helped me. They both helped to set me on the spiritual path that I'm on now, the journey that I am now. And so, as you know, I look back, I certainly appreciate it. But most importantly, I think what I've gotten, or what I've learned the most from that journey, is that there is a power inside of us, a spirit inside of us, every human being. And we all have the ability to tap into that power. It exists within us, but it also exists outside of us. And so as a teenager, I'm learning, you know, the difference between spirituality and religion. And I'm also learning how to tap into this power. I'm also learning to see, I'm able to see with this knowledge that I have how certain things in my life have played out, why they played out the way that they did, and what my role was. I was able to apply the same understanding to other people, understanding why they are who they are, why their life has turned out in different ways. And it was the understanding of spiritual concepts and universal laws that really provided me a solid foundation. And with that foundation, I know that if I fail, the only reason I will fail or did or would fail is because of me. It's not because of any outside influence. And so I learned to take responsibility for my thoughts, my words, and my actions. And as I'm learning to take responsibility for that, I'm able to have more control over how things manifest in my life. And so this spiritual journey, I believe that it's lifelong. You know, it doesn't end when I, you know, hit retirement age. It continues throughout my life, and so I'm always learning. I know that I'm not perfect, and there are different areas in which I can improve. But even as far as knowledge, you know, when you really start coming into consciousness, you realize how much you don't know. And every time you open a door, you know, learning new information, that opens up three doors. It's like things, it's never ending cycle of doors just opening up, in the sense of learning new information and just this lifelong process of learning that will continue into the day we transition.
Amazing. And I think what was profound to me listening to you, being such a deep study and a deep researcher and a reader, and one who will look to find the answer, how nothing was forced on you. It was like a drip effect in this exposure process that you found, along your journey. Like nobody force fed anything to you. And I think, oftentimes, we do that a lot with our children. And instead of being and looking for ways to infuse this cultural greatness on them at their level of comfort, and browbeating them or, subjugating them to whatever our spiritual inclination is without regard to what they're here to do. That thing is very important. Everybody has a mission. Everybody has an assignment, and we have, tools within the confines of African culture to find out exactly who they are and what they're here to do and how we're supposed to help guide them along the path. It takes a lot of the experimental things out of the way, but until we're
I was just going to mention, as you said, that it reminded me of a book, I believe it's called Of Water and Spirit, by Patrice Somme. But in that book, he talks about African culture and something specifically about the mother when she is pregnant, when that baby is in her womb. The individuals within that community, they do a ceremony in which they tap into the spirit of the child that's still in the womb, and they communicate with this spirit to find out what their mission is. You might have heard people say that when we transition from the spiritual realm to the physical realm, that we consciously tend to lose our memory. But on a subconscious level, all of that information is there, and so it's about tapping into that consciousness. And so what these African people did is, communicate with the spirit in the mother's womb and find out why that child is here. And so now the adults in that community will be responsible for creating an environment that's conducive to that child and supports whatever their mission or purpose in life is. And so, that's just an example of, just one aspect of our culture that we've lost, and young people are coming into this world not really living fully, and many of them not even, to some extent, not even becoming conscious of spirituality or that they even have a purpose or mission in life until they're well into their adulthood. And so there's so many things that we have to do to provide a foundation for our young people so that they don't have to waste 20, 30 years of their lives. Give them the information early on so that they can be more informed and make better decisions.
Agreed. I think today is 127 years, I believe, ago that our ancestor Harriet Tubman escaped. I believe that's today. So I'm just thinking about the parallels between the conversation and what this actually means to us. I know there was a film that came out recently, in her honor. I don't know. I'm curious to hear people's thoughts about it. I saw a lot of conversation about it, but I just remember, I believe it's today, that this was the day that she escaped, from bondservant, and the kind of track that she took, and the mind frame, and the resilience of this African woman who literally walked by faith and not by sight. You know what I mean? To freedom.
Right.
And was not one who was content with her journey being complete and reaching liberation. She went back and got her brothers and sisters. You know, went back and got, you know, those brothers and sisters so many times because they deserved to have that feeling that she had, you know, when she had made it to her freedom. You know, that, so this is like groundbreaking, you know. And if we look at Maryland, you know, D.C. and these other particular areas, you know, coming through, it's like full circle, you know, for me, in my mind, in regards to this journey back to who we are. Like, we literally going through this toil and, you know, this much from a metaphysical and psychological perspective that she did physically as well, you know, and not being content with that, you know, liberation and going back and getting our brothers and sisters. So I just wanted to take a second and point that out on today. So can we get into the ASA Restoration Project? How did that come about? You know, this is another first for you. You know, how has it been for you thus far? And what kind of reception has the world, you know, given you and your father on this, you know, actual excavation and restoration project?
So the ASA Restoration Project is a nonprofit that my father created in 2018. And he created this this project, the ASA Restoration Project, for a number of reasons. So my father's been traveling to Egypt, taking study tours to Egypt for decades now. And around 2018 is when my father met a woman by the name of Alina Pishakova. She's a Russian-born Egyptologist. And she is, she had been working, excavating sites in Egypt, and so an individual who is now deceased is the person who kind of set everything up or made it possible for my father to meet Elena. And so you know, this friend of my dad's actually was his very very first tour guide in Egypt, who he was really close with. And so he knew of my father's approach to Egyptian or Kemetic history and wanted to connect him with Elena, who was excavating a tomb of a 25th dynasty priest. And so when he met her, she practically had run out of money and was concerned that she wasn't going to be able to continue this excavation. But when my father met her, and learned her story, learned more about the 25th dynasty from her perspective, he really admired what she was trying to do. Most people might be aware that traditional Egyptologists, they acknowledge the 25th dynasty as being the only African or Negro dynasty. And so with that belief, it implies that the previous dynasties are non-African. But, of course, anybody who has been to Africa, who studied the works of Dr. John Hewitt Clark or Asa Hilliard or Ivan Van Sertima, we know that the original people of the country that we now call Egypt, these were African people. And so Elena acknowledged that as well. And so essentially my father fell in love with her story and the work that she was committed to doing. And because she was because she was essentially running out of money, my father committed to funding this project. And so this was in 2018, and he created the Aether Restoration Project to, one, honor his Jugna, which is Asa G. Hilliard. And so Asa, A-S-A, stands for Asa, but it also stands for the location where we're excavating, which is in South Ephesus, which is in, it's on the west bank of Luxor. And so Hello?
Yes, I hear you. Can you hear me? Okay. Looks like we're having some technical difficulties. The phone number to call in, family, if you have questions or you have comments, 929-477-1755. Again, 929-477-1755. Press 1 with your questions or your comments. Okay, we got our sister back on the line. We're going to bring her back in right now. Hey, sister, are you back with us?
Yes, yes. I'm not sure what happened. Got disconnected. So I'm not sure the last thing that you heard me say.
You were talking about Asa in reference to the location being on the West Bank. Luxor.
Okay. And so that's where the name comes from, Asa, A-S-A. And so in 2008, when he made that trip and decided that he was going to support this work, that's exactly what my father did. He fundraised. He's never fundraised before, but he began fundraising for this project. And so ultimately, we became, as African Americans, the primary funder of this excavation project. And so that's what we've been doing for the past 11 years now, funding the excavation, but then also creating opportunities for African Americans to come and actually work at a site. We are the first African Americans to participate in an archaeological excavation. And so we are excavating two 25th dynasty tombs. One in particular belongs to a man by the name of Karakamun, who was a 25th dynasty priest. And actually over the progress that we've made and because of the enormous support, we've been able to actually complete the excavation of Karakamun's temple tomb. And we're in the process of restoring and conserving it. And so we actually plan to have a public opening of the site in 2023. And so I do want to encourage your listeners, if they've never been to Egypt and they're interested, if you need some time to save up some money, go ahead and do that and plan to be with us in 2023. To celebrate the opening of Karakamun's temple tomb. And the reason why I call it a temple tomb is because when most people either travel to Egypt or learn about Egyptian history or culture, they're more familiar with one of two sites, either temples that were designed to obviously acknowledge the ruler at the time, but also every temple was dedicated to a netcher, an Egyptian or Kemetic netcher, an aspect or principle of the creator. And so we have temples, but then we also have tombs. So like if you go to the Valley of the Kings and Queens or Nobles on the West Bank, you'll find these tombs. But what's unique about Karakamun site is that it's a temple and it's a tomb. So the outer portion of the site serves as a tomb where people can come to do libations and perform other activities. And then as you go further into the site, it leads to his burial chamber. And so that's very unique, or particularly unique to the 25th dynasty. And so the second site that we are excavating belongs to a man by the name of Kerbastian, who was the mayor of Waset, which is now known as Luxor Incarnet. And for those people who don't know, you know, when many people get excited about traveling to Egypt, you know, the first thing they think about is seeing the pyramids or the Sphinx, Haram Akhet. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that, but what most people don't realize is that over 70% of what there is to see in Egypt is located in Luxor, which is where we're excavating. So we've come a long way, and I have to be acknowledged that when my father first got involved, I was a little bit skeptical. You know, I wasn't familiar with, you know, working with an archaeological dig, and I didn't know this woman, Elena, but as my father got to know her and really understand where she was going with this work, he continued to support, continued to fundraise, and so after maybe the first 3 or 4 years, and mind you, I've been working at the site every year for the last 10 to 11 years, spending anywhere from 2 weeks to about a month or so working at the site, doing a variety of things. And so the more opportunities that I had to visit the site and have conversations with Elena, I realized that this was divine. This was supposed to happen. And so I'm really proud of my father for committing to this, because there were so many times where he wanted to give up. You know, he felt that, you know, especially in the beginning, people didn't understand what we were doing. You know, I can understand how some people might be concerned about giving their money towards a project that, you know, you don't know how it's going to unfold. But there have been a number of people who have been with us since day one, since 2008. And so because of the support that we've had over the last 11 years, we've been able to complete the excavation, as I mentioned earlier, and now we're preparing to open the tomb to the public. So this has been an opportunity for us to not only discover history, but also to rewrite history. One of the beautiful things about Karakamun's temple tomb is that it is a representation of the Renaissance. There are a number of things within this temple tomb that show how Karakamun was trying to go back to his past, to bring forth things from the third or fourth dynasty in terms of texts and even, you know, certain old kingdom poses. And so there's many examples of how Karakamun was going back to his past to bring forth culture, traditions, and you know, specific practices that he knew his ancestors followed. And so what we're also able to do is show how the 25th dynasty is connected to the previous dynasties. So there's a lot of work and a lot more research that we need to do. But for those who are interested in learning more about the information, they can go to our website at ikge-info.com. If they're interested in taking a study tour with us, they can get that information on our website. And every study tour that we take to Egypt, they also have an opportunity to visit the excavation site. Most people have never been to an active archaeological site. And so there's so many opportunities for people to get involved and support this work, because indeed we are making history. So you can either be here with us on that journey, or you can watch from the sidelines, which some people have chosen to do.
And is there a spot for people who want to donate?
Yes. And, you know, just to be clear, the only way that we've been able to continue this work is through donations. We don't get any, you know, government grants. The primary donors are individuals. When we started this project 11 years ago, it cost approximately $10,000 a month, so $40,000 for a four-month excavation season. And every year, we've been able to meet those goals because people have financially supported us. And so the beautiful thing about this work is that we're able to show you the work that we've done. You can see the progress that we've made. You can see how your funds are being used towards continuing this work. So if anybody's interested in financially supporting the project, they can also go to our website as well, ikg-info.com.
All right. I thought I saw a GoFundMe. Is that old or?
That might be an old platform that we were using, but I would encourage people to go directly to our website where they can either choose to make a one-time donation or they could be a part of the 400 Club where we were initially seeking 400 people to sign up to donate $10 a month for an entire year. So there are a number of different ways that people can support financially.
All right. And I will help spread the word as best as possible. I also saw that y'all have some events coming up. Do you want to talk about those events? And as well as I heard through the grapevine that there's a book being released.
So two things. This coming Saturday, if you have any listeners that are in the DMV or maybe want to come down to check out our event, this Saturday, December 7th, from 11 to about 3 p.m., we're going to be at the Thurgood Marshall Center. And so we're going to be celebrating two things. First and foremost, Brother Renoko Rashidi will be our guest of honor, and he is doing a book signing. And we'll be sharing information about his recent publication, which is called Black and Beautiful in the Ancient World. So we're also doing a photo exhibit where he selected several of maybe the top photos that he felt were important for people to see for this event. And so he's displaying those images, and we're going to be celebrating him, celebrating his work. And then we're also going to introduce to the public the John Henry Clark Enhanced History Project. And so one of the reasons for this project, it was inspired after my father visited the National Museum of African American History and Culture in Washington, D.C., and he noticed how, you know, as great as this museum is, has, you know, many amazing artifacts, but they don't mention anything about African history and African accomplishments prior to slavery. And so anybody who goes into that museum ultimately will reinforce on some level the idea that our history started with slavery. And so with this Enhanced History Project, we're providing information so that people can learn about African history, our history prior to slavery. And so we encourage people to come by and visit the Thurgood Marshall Center, which is located at 1816 12th Street Northwest. This exhibit will be open in March of next year. So we encourage people to come either before or after they visit the museum so that they can have a more complete understanding of who we are, but more specifically, the accomplishments and experiences of African people prior to slavery. So that event, again, is this Saturday at the Thurgood Marshall Center. And then the last thing I do want to share is information about the release of my new book that will be coming out at the end of this month. I mentioned to you at the beginning of the show that I wrote my first book at the age of 8 called My First Trip to Africa. And so at the end of this month, we will be releasing a revised edition of that book, and it's titled Reflections of My First Trip to Africa. So since 1989, I've been to Egypt 13 times, traveling with my father, assisting him with the study tour, and also working with the mission. And so this book is, as I mentioned, it's revised, but it includes my perspective about this trip, from the age that I am now, which is 37, we also included a little bit of information about the excavation. And so I would encourage people to look out for that. If you have any young people, you know, for your audience, if you have any young people in their lives, children, siblings, nieces and nephews, I encourage them to get this book so that our young people can begin to learn about African history and see it through the eyes of an African-American female.
Most definitely. We have to get some books and do a giveaway over here. So I'll be in contact with you about getting some books so we could do a giveaway over here on Do the Knowledge Radio. We support our own down here.
Absolutely. I appreciate that.
All right. And the last thing I wanted to ask you, because I want to, you know, stay to the time. So you in the DVD, the documentary Out of Darkness, how did that happen? How did that come about? And what was that experience like for you?
Well, actually, a brother from the West Coast, from California, named Chris Reiser, reached out to my father and I about, you know, interviewing us for this documentary. When I met him, I was not familiar with him or his work, but we were open to, my father and I were open to doing this interview, video interview, and we did know that it was a part of this project he was working on, but I don't think we had any idea that it was going to turn out the way that it did. I often compare Out of Darkness to Hidden Colors. You know, it's kind of on that level with the visuals and then, of course, the information. So I was really happy to be a part of that project. And, you know, every once in a while I'll, you know, meet people who say that they saw me in the documentary and they learned a lot from what I had to share. So Chris Reiser is also in the process of working on part two of that documentary, which hopefully will be out within the next year or two. So I encourage your listeners to look out for, be on the lookout for that.
I know it was a part two. We're learning all kinds of jewels here today on Do Not Radio. I'm proud. If you have any closing remarks, any acknowledgments, anything you want to plug, anybody you want to, you know, shout out, whatever the case may be, you have the opportunity. Please, one more time before you go, let people know where and how to donate to the excavation project, and you know that time that it be made public, and how people can reach you via social media.
Absolutely. So I do want to start off by acknowledging my father, who should be listening. I really want to thank him for all the time and energy and money that he's poured into me, and really supporting me on the path that I'm on. I also want to acknowledge Marion David, many of my friends who I've grown up with, who have really supported my work and have always encouraged me. Because as a child, you know, I didn't have a lot of friends that were aware of African history and culture. They weren't necessarily supportive. And so I do appreciate those family and friends who have supported our work. And I want to encourage your listeners to check out our publications, some of my publications, as well as my father's. They can get that information or make that purchase on our website, which is ikg-info.com. So again, check out our publications, and for more information about the ASA Restoration Project, how to donate, or if you're interested in traveling to Egypt with Anthony Browder, check out our website, and I can promise you that going on the study tour will change your life. I don't care how much you've read and studied about Egyptian history. When you travel there for yourself, it's really life-changing. But traveling with Mr. Browder takes it to another level, because we don't just visit the sites, When the average person goes to Egypt, they'll learn about the European interpretation of Egyptian history, but we begin, we start from the beginning. We give you facts, documented research. We're not just giving our opinions, but what makes my father's study tours unique is that he does lectures in the evening. So after a day of, you know, going out to visit the sites in the evening, you'll come back. And he'll help you to make connections with what you saw, as well as to expand your consciousness about other things that are relevant to, you know, having a spiritual journey, continuing a spiritual journey, and just personal growth. So all that information is on our website, ikg-info.com.
All right. Well, thank you for your time. And for all of the wonderful jewels that you dropped on us today. If Baba is listening, Baba, we love you. We supported your work, and you have been a guide for many of us over the years. And we hope one day that y'all could come through together, or we can get Baba and get a part of that story as well. So. And anytime you have anything you want to promote, anything you want to share, if you just want to come and vent, you know, this is a place for you over here. You understand what I'm saying? To come and to speak and to engage our people on every level you see fit. And as I said at the beginning, before we went live, this is yours to keep. So this is now your intellectual property.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. And I certainly appreciate you reaching out to me to be on your show. I definitely look forward to, you know, being a returning guest. And, you know, thank you for providing a space for me where I can vent or talk about anything that's going on that is important to our people. So thank you for that. And I appreciate you for having this platform so that we can educate our people and continue much needed work that we have to do.
All right. Hopefully I'll make one of those trips. You know, the last time I've been to Kemen, it was about 2005. That was the last time. So it's been a while. I'm overdue.
Okay. Right. Well, look, plan to join us in 2023, if not sooner.
All right. Well, you enjoy the rest of your day. And again, thank you for your time.
All right. Thank you. You have a great one.